All right, we're in Luke chapter 19. Sorry for the faded print on these. I need to change my toner. I meant to do it before, but anyway, hope that's readable. Luke chapter 19, and we'll start at verse number 28. This last parable that he told before this section here is a good transition, because a big part of this parable that he told that we went over last time is the parable of the pounds, the minas, is a warning to them or an encouragement to them to be ready for his return. And so now this brings him to the final part of his ministry when he's going to be leaving. And so he's been preparing them for that. And so this really marks the transition from the middle part, which is the journey to Jerusalem, to this last part of the book, which is Jerusalem and what happens there. As he's been talking, he's warned them repeatedly about what's going to happen when he comes to Jerusalem, and his various language, various things he said, has given us a kind of a sense of foreboding about Jerusalem. We know something's going to happen at Jerusalem. And we all know the story, of course, but the way the narrative is structured, you know, that gives us now that, and there's been a lot of vagueness about, you know, they haven't been real specific about exactly where they were or what the time frame was. It's been a little bit, wasn't very important that it was real specific and detailed, but now it gets pretty specific and detailed. Now it says they were in these villages that are right outside Jerusalem, and it was this time, and what was going on, the Passover and so forth, which kind of focuses our attention on the immediacy and the urgency of the crisis that is now coming. That the crisis that has been building between Jesus and the religious rulers and the civil rulers of Judea is now coming to a climax. Verse number 28. When he had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. And it came to pass, when he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany at the mountain called Olivet, that he sent two of his disciples, saying, "Go into the village opposite you, where as you enter you will find a colt tied on which no one has ever sat. Loose it and bring it here. And if anyone asks you, 'Why are you loosing it?' thus you shall say to him, 'Because the Lord has need of it. So those who were sent went their way and found it just as he had said to them. But as they were loosening the colt, the owners of it said to them, 'Why are you loosing the colt?' And they said, 'The Lord has need of him.' Then they brought him to Jesus. And they threw their own clothes on the colt and set Jesus on him. And as he went, many spread their clothes on the road. Then as he was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' And some of the Pharisees called to him from the crowd, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' But he answered and said to them, 'I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out.' Now as he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, 'If you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you, and close you in on every side, and level you and your children with you to the ground. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation.'" Okay, let's stop there. All right, so the first part of the story is this colt. Now in Luke, he does not explicitly tie this to Old Testament prophecy, though the other Gospels do. And in Zechariah 9, verse 9, which is a prophecy, is definitely messianic, he says, the prophet says in Israel 9, verse 9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." And here it's identified simply as a colt that no one has ridden on before. The other gospels identify it as the colt of a donkey, and specifically refer to Zechariah 9, verse 9. It's kind of interesting to note that that was not a passage that at this time, at the time this happened, that the rabbis really thought of in a messianic sense. They didn't really think of it as a messianic prophecy. It wasn't identified as one of them. And John 12 verse 16, it tells us that the disciples didn't think of the prophecy. They didn't think of what was written. They didn't connect this event. They didn't know why Jesus was doing this. They didn't connect this event to the prophecy. It says, until after Jesus was glorified. And then they remembered, you know, as they were thinking along things. So this, you know, I think it adds weight to the idea of everything that's going on here. Jesus is doing deliberately, and Jesus is, he's in control of what's going on. It's really important as we draw through the betrayal and the trial and the crucifixion and everything that happens, that Jesus is never a helpless victim. None of this is just things that are happening to him. He's in control throughout. We see repeated times when it would have been very easy for him to evade the trouble. Just consider the fact, as I'll point out in a moment, that all through his ministry, you remember all these times when Jesus would tell them he would do some miracle or something would happen, and he would say, "Don't tell anybody. Don't spread the word. Keep it quiet," because he's wanting to control the pace at which the revelation of his messiahship gets out. But he's not doing that now. Now he's publicly declaring himself, really, as we'll see. The prophecy, the fact that this wasn't a case of one of these self-fulfilling prophecies where somebody says, the Messiah is supposed to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, and so Jesus gets a donkey to ride in so that he can say he's the Messiah. No, nobody really thought of that passage like that. And yet, Jesus knows what it's about.
So when he did, you think the religious leaders understood what it was?
I don't know that they connected it to. They connected it to the prophecy, but what the other disciples were saying makes it pretty clear. Because the way they address him as he's coming in is explicitly messianic, as we'll see in a moment here. So that's why they say, "Rebuke your disciples." Okay, so why the colt of a donkey in particular? Well, Zechariah connects it to Jesus' lowliness. We just read that passage. Your king is coming lowly on a donkey, on the foal of a donkey. Sometimes people have said, "Well, a donkey is a poor man's animal," and that doesn't really capture the idea here. A donkey is a little bit of a poor man's animal, a little bit more. You think of a richer man riding on a horse, but actually that doesn't. People didn't use horses really for anything but war at this time and in this place. It wasn't like the American West where people did agriculture or transportation on horseback. Horses were very expensive, and they were used almost entirely for war. People ride on horseback to fight. But a donkey was a peacetime animal. It was an animal you would do agriculture on, or you'd travel from place to place. That was a common use of a donkey. So a king, this is a kind of a triumphal entry. The kings would ride in procession back into their capital city after a victorious campaign, after a battle or something that they'd won. They'd been out to war. Or a king that was, if a man wanted to, like when Caesar wants to claim the throne of Rome, and he's defeated his enemies, they've had the civil war, and the Caesar won, when Julius won, then his army, they'd all get together, and he'd ride in victorious procession into Rome. And as he went in, he'd be on horseback. And that would be, he's this fearless, victorious military leader, right? That is the typical, you know, somebody riding in on horseback. He rides in on a donkey. And that shows, again, like we've seen all through the book, it's a different kind of kingdom. You know, it's pursued a different way. It's achieved a different way. This is not like the military kingdoms of the world. And so that's really, I think, the import of the donkey. They shout praises to him. They say, blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. That is, as I said before, it's messianic language. Blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord is a quote from Psalm 118. And Psalm 118 is a messianic psalm. It's talking about the king, you know, the coming Messiah. And so when they say, blessed is he who the king who comes in the name of the Lord, they're not just complimenting Jesus. They're not just saying he's a good man, he's a, you know, a prophet, a rabbi, you know, whatever. They're saying he's the Messiah. They're explicitly acknowledging him as the Messiah. Peace in heaven, glory in the highest. They're saying he's the, you know, in Matthew, they say Hosanna to the Son of David. You know, see things like that, and that they are addressing him as the Messiah. And they're doing so publicly, and they're doing so loudly, and they're doing so in a crowd, in a procession, right? So this is very, very dramatic, and they're doing it at Passover. Right? Which is huge because everybody's down there. You recall there were three feasts that every Jewish male was in the law was supposed to go to. In practice, an observant Jew would go to one of those feasts each year. And Passover was always the most popular. So there were a lot of people coming into Jerusalem, and they're seeing this spectacle of Jesus coming in, this crowd following him, laying their clothes down in front of him, and shouting in this crowd all of this very messianic language. So this is a big deal. And then you see why the Pharisees get so nervous about this. They may have been, they say, teacher, rebuke your disciples. Now they may be... and some say, well, they were worried. They had a cause to be concerned that if the Romans heard this stuff, if the Romans see a crowd coming in and declaring this man their king, you know what the Romans are going to do. So maybe they're couching it in that language. But the whole thing with the Pharisees all the way through, and even right here in this very passage where there's continued opposition, shows that if that was the excuse they were using for what they were saying, what's really driving them is envy and resentment. You know, they resent Jesus for his popularity. They resent his the influence he has with the crowds. Jesus' response, as we said before, he's been restraining. He's been keeping things quiet. When Peter says, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of God," you know, he says, "Don't tell anybody." He's not doing that now. This is his time. And that just adds to our sense of crisis. You know, now it's all out in the open. Now there are no more parables, no more kind of, you know, being coy about things. This is out in the open now. And so he says, "I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out." And here he's saying, you know, the Messiah of Israel is coming into Jerusalem to claim his kingdom. Silence is not an option. Nature itself would proclaim who he was if people didn't. They lay their cloaks, other garments in the road ahead of Jesus, a sign of honor for an approaching king. Oh, I see. I started to write this paragraph and didn't finish it. Other gospels also tell us that the people waved palm branches and laid them in the road. Something Luke omits, and probably because he's not writing to a Jewish audience. Luke is writing to a Gentile audience, and a Gentile audience probably wouldn't understand the significance of the palm branches. The palm branches are associated in the Jewish mind with the Messianic age, and the And they get that way because of the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles is one of the great feasts where they celebrate the God's preservation of them through the wilderness. It's the Feast of Booths, right? So they would make their booths. They're like little temporary dwellings like they lived in the desert. And they would, and it says to overlay them with palm branches, what they would find in the desert to make their little shelters out of. And so it's the celebration of God's preservation of them through the wilderness on the way to the promised land. So you see why the Feast of Tabernacles ongoing is very much looking, it's a metaphor for this life, for we're in the wilderness now, but the promised land is coming, right? The Messianic age is coming. And they would wave their palm branches as part of this, as part of the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. They would come into Jerusalem because there aren't a lot of palm trees in Jerusalem. They would carry their palms in, and so in procession, you know, coming up and chanting psalms, they would be waving their palm branches in the air in anticipation of celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. There's a the coins that were coined, the temple coins in Jerusalem through this period, had a palm branch on one side and an inscription saying, Redemption in Zion, you know. So the palm branches are very strongly associated with, and so that it became a custom that they would often wave palm branches, even at other feasts, not the Feast of Tabernacles, like Passover and so forth. So they're waving their palm branches, you know, as Jesus is coming in and everything else that's going on. You know, it's, as I said, very, very dramatic. Very dramatic. And I'm sure they all thought that he was going to come right in, declare himself the king, kick out the Romans, set up the kingdom. Bam, you know. But there's still, obviously, some twists and turns in the road ahead. Okay, so he has this last paragraph here. As I've said, he's often sought to restrain the declaration of himself as the Messiah. Obviously, he's not doing that anymore. Now he's making it public, making it known, which brings us to, obviously, the coming of this this climax. What we're going to see here in this last section, verses 45 through 48, I'm not going to touch on tonight because I think that really belongs better with the next section as it talks about the final conflicts and the final attempts of the Jews to trap him, to confront his teachings, leading to the you know, their just complete frustration with him and their betrayal, their betrayal and arrest of him. So then the last thing we want to look at here is then verse 41 through 44. He drew near and he saw the city and he wept over it. The word for weeping there is there's a couple of different Greek words that can be used. This one indicates wailing, a loud, like at a funeral. It's a very strong emotions indicated here. Bewailing the fate of Jerusalem, because he knows what's coming. He says they were ignorant of the things that make for your peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. The make for your peace, that is that, you know, they were ignorant of the way they could be reconciled with God, the way they could have peace with God. They could have had peace at any time. If they trust God, if they'd repented of sin, then they would have been at peace with God and with man. God always said that if they followed him and they worshipped him and they didn't follow after other idols, then they would have peace. He would protect them from their enemies and guard them, and that was always promised to them. In the Old Testament, of course, there was, in the childhood of the church, there were always immediate temporal blessings that would accompany true faith. God said you'll have prosperity and your flocks will grow and your crops will be great and you'll have lots of kids and you'll have protection from your enemies and all these things. And it's we don't see the same promises for the Christian church in the New Testament. Actually, quite the contrary. Jesus promises them and us that you'll have trouble in the world. There'll be tribulation and people will hate you and so forth. In a less mature stage of the church, there were always these immediate outward blessings that were attached to obedience. And that's part of what he's saying here. But even more so, more importantly, more broadly, that they would have had peace with God. And they would have assurance of pardon and so forth had they trusted in him. And if they had trusted in him, if they believed in him, then they would have accepted his son. They would have accepted Jesus. The fact that they didn't accept Jesus proves that they, as he says over and over again, if you'd believed Moses, you would have received me. If you knew God, then you would have accepted him that came from God. And so he knows this is the end for them. And so he says the hour of their visitation at the end of verse number 44. He says, you did not know the time of your visitation. That word visitation is episcope, from which we get the word episkopos, which means bishop. A bishop is an overseer. Somebody like someone who oversees a work gang or something like that is kind of the idea. So that word visitation is your inspection, is kind of the idea. That the overseer is coming to inspect your labors and you're going to be found wanting. This is the hour you didn't know. Like the master returning to the house and finding the servants not working and getting drunk and beating the other servants. Or the master coming back to the vineyard and saying, okay, it's time to pay up the rents on the vineyard, and the husbandmen have stolen it all. You know, what does the master do? That's what visitation, at the time of your visitation, the time of your inspection, I think is a great word for it. That's what he's saying is coming on them. And this is, besides, of course, Jesus has been generally applying these things, these ideas, not just to Jerusalem, but to us in general, that for all of us, you know, the inspection is going to come. And we never know when that's going to happen. None of us individually know when it is that we are going to be called before the throne of God to give account. It could happen any time for any of us or all of us collectively. If we wait until that moment, then it's going to be too late. And Jesus told that parable of the rich farmer who was satisfied of himself, wasn't right with God, and thought he was secure, thought he was safe. That night he died, had to go give account. And now it's Jerusalem as a whole that's in this boat. The time of their visitation has come. We have the opportunity now to get on the right side of God's justice, an opportunity that God has graciously provided in the gospel of Jesus Christ. The wise man will ensure that his account is balanced before the check posts. So Jesus' prophecy here is speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And of course his prophecy was fulfilled. Now his statements here in verse 43 and 44 are pretty general statements. He doesn't say anything really specific about how that siege is going to happen. What he describes was just pretty common procedure for a Roman siege. This was just how you build embankments. They would build an outer wall around the inner. They had their wall, but they would build another wall around that to prevent anybody from escaping. If you were really wanting to destroy a people, and this is what the Romans did, was they moved through Judea slowly and gradually in order to kind of herd everybody into Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was just, and that way you deal with the whole problem all at once. You don't have stragglers and guerrilla warfare and all that stuff going on then. You utterly crush them. If a sizable part of the army escapes the siege, you know, then you've got to continue dealing with them for years, possibly. But if you can get them all in one place, trap them in, and destroy them completely, then you can be assured of victory. And that's what they did. And so they build another wall outside of the first wall, you know, their Jerusalem's wall. They build their own wall around that. That embankment also gives you high points to use catapults and things like various siege equipment and so forth. And that's what they did. So they built an embankment, and they surrounded, they closed them in on every side, and they leveled them. And as he said, not one stone would be left upon another, which indicates not just a limited defeat, but just utter destruction, which is, of course, what happened to Jerusalem. Now, some say that this proves that people who don't believe in prophecy say that proves that Luke must have been written after 70 AD. But his language is pretty general. If they were fabricating a prophecy, seems pretty likely you'd make it more specific to that particular situation. But you don't see any of that. It's, like I said, just general language. And as we talked about before at the beginning of the book, Luke and Acts, we know, are written together. The book of Acts ends with Paul in Rome, still alive, right? And we know Paul died in Rome. Even secular non-Christian historians know that Paul died in Rome around 65 AD because of the in the persecutions of Nero, and that puts a kind of a framework on how late it could have been written. So it must have been written, you know, 63, 64, 65 AD, right in there somewhere. So not only was the prophecy made, of course, Jesus spoke these words 40 years before it happened, but even Luke wrote down and recorded the prophecy 5 or 6 or 7 years before it happened. But it did happen in 70 AD. The meaning of the statement, combined with the whole story of Jesus' ministry to Israel and their rejection and crucifixion of him, followed by their predicted judgment in 70 AD, is that God's purposes for Jerusalem as the unique city of God has come to an end. And the Jewish race's position as God's chosen people is likewise at an end. The tree will be cut down. In Matthew, after Jesus, his condemnation of the religious rulers of Israel, he says, "Your house is left to you desolate," at the end of that in Matthew chapter 23, which he speaks in Jerusalem just before his crucifixion. Your house is left to you desolate. Your house meaning your place, your authority, your office, your station. Your house is left to you empty. Ruined. It's done. And the ethnic Jewish people of Israel, through all these declarations, that God is finished with them, that this is the end of it. Jerusalem or Judea as a special place in God's economy or providence is done. It's finished. It's the end. Now, Israel as a spiritual concept, Israel as what it always was, goes on. The Israel, the tree, it's the languages that Paul uses or Jesus uses in different places, that the tree is cut down. But the tree, the stump survives. And in the stump is grafted in all the Gentiles and onto the remnants of believing Jews. Because, of course, the whole early church was Jewish. And the Gentiles are grafted into that. And the new tree grows out of that stump and is something that far exceeds anything that had come before. But this is signaling a very dramatic and strong change in God's, you know, going forward from here. Israel as an ethnic people, as a geographic, geopolitical nation, would have no special place in God's eyes. It was out to the whole world. So, any questions or thoughts about any of that?
So its purpose, the nation of Israel, was over. Its purpose in God's plan was over.
Israel as a geopolitical nation, yes. Israel as a spiritual concept, of course, we are the new Israel. Right. We are the people of God. But yes, those particular ethnic descendants of Abraham in that particular land, yeah, that's done. Which doesn't mean, and Christians have often made the mistake of thinking that means Jews are now especially hated in God's eyes. And that would be a mistake. As Paul shows extensively in Romans, especially Romans 9 through 11, Jews will continue to be saved throughout the age. And Jews are, they continually converted, and that we should not lift, just as the Jews were lifted up in pride against the Gentiles and therefore were thrown down, so the Gentiles should now not be lifted up in pride against the Jews. And so the Jews are on the same footing. They're on the same footing as all the nations of the world.
What accounts for the hatred all over the world of Jews?
Well, that's a complex subject. And there's lots of different theories about that. Of course, the dispensationalists will have one explanation of that they are still God's chosen people, and I don't think that's true. I don't know how it is that God's chosen people could be atheists, could just not believe in God at all. Some people say that the Jews are especially wicked, that they're cursed by God for having. That was the common medieval perspective, was that the Jews had killed Jesus and therefore as a race was cursed by God forever and would continue to suffer. I'm not sure I would take that position either. The explanation, I think, on one degree has to do with the dynamics of the, and this is getting a little bit away from the Bible study, but I think it has to do with the dynamics of the fact that the Jews have stayed together as their own culture, as their own people, their own nation, all through the last 2,000 years, even at the same time as they are living in other people's countries, right? So they are living in other people's countries, in many ways looking like those other people, dressing like them, speaking like them, outwardly like them, but inwardly still keeping their primary loyalty not to whatever nation they're living in, but to the Jewish nation. Now, nobody finds it odd when a German acts in the interests of Germany or an Englishman acts in the interests of England. That's what you would expect. And so, when a Jew acts in the interests of Israel in its dispersion, that shouldn't be surprising. The problem is that Jew is living and working among the Germans or the French or the Russians or whoever, right? And that creates friction over time as people who live in your country but do not appear to be loyal to your country, that they're loyal to an international network of people, you know. So that, for example, during World War I, you had Jews in Germany that had German names and spoke German. You had Jews in England who had English names and spoke English, but they would work with one another to maximize profits from the sale of, they would actually be a common commercial interest selling arms to both sides of the conflict. Jews in Germany held a monopoly in lead, for example, and so they made a killing off of selling lead to the German people for bullets, you know, during the World War I. So they acted in the interests of, but to the German people, it felt like you're supposed to be a German and living in Germany, you should be loyal to Germany, but they weren't. So that creates friction and that creates hostility and tension. It builds up over time. Now the question that's arisen is, why do other nations who are in this position, they just blend in, they just become whatever. They lose their distinctive cultural identity, usually. The Roma, the Gypsies, are another example of one that haven't really done that, but they've always been on the fringes. They've always been not part of regular society. And that's where I think God's providence probably does play a role, that this people, having been under God's providence for as long as he... I think that stamps them. I think that marks them with that character, and that's something that continues to, even though they're in rebellion against it, really, that continues to hold them together as a nation. It continues to kind of have their stamp on them. And they're very successful everywhere they go. They're smart, they're hardworking, they're focused, they work together, and they're always successful. And that also, you know, you consider the fact that in our country, Jews make up about 0.5% of the population of the nation. And they have 4 out of the 9 seats on the Supreme Court. Jews do, you know. Now that seems a little overrepresentative, doesn't it? You know, almost half of the makeup of one of the most powerful bodies in the country when they only make up 0.5% of the population. Yet it's a fact.
Well, it wasn't intentional.
Well, no, it wasn't any conspiracy. I don't think anybody set out to do that. All I'm saying is they're very talented people and they succeed where they go.
Well,
you know,
you refer to them as successful. Most people who deal with them over the years would say they're shrewd.
And then you have those stereotypes there.
Yeah, if you enter into a business deal with a Jew,
they bargain hard.
Yeah, they're probably going to lose.
And they're clever, and they're better
in the deal.
Yeah, and so those sorts of things when they're wealthy, when they're successful, when they hold together as a nation, when they appear to be like you, but you know, kind of secretly they're not.
Yeah.
They maintain their own customs and their own loyalties to their own people. Then over time, there's this cycle that always goes. A nation welcomes them in, is good to them. They prosper in that nation. They get rich. Over time, that creates envy and hostility. They always have things they do on their own side. The various, you know, they'll, like I said, get monopolies or different things like that. And that leads to outbreaks of violence, and it's happened over and over and over again. You know, the whole thing that happened in Nazi Germany was only one of the most severe in a long-standing pattern of things that has happened over and over and over and over again. They've been expelled from dozens of countries. You know, I mean, the whole Nazi Germany thing, the way they regarded and treated the Jews was not a historical aberration. It's, like I said, it's happened over and over and over and over again.
It seems like it goes back a long way.
You know, I don't think so, because I know the Muslims think of themselves as the descendants of Ishmael. I don't think they really actually are in any meaningful sense. Besides that, though, they have often shown plenty of hostility to Christians. The situation today between the Arabs and the Jews, or the Muslims and the Jews, I should say, not the Arabs and the Jews, but the Muslims and the Jews, is relatively recent. The Jews being the target of all the Muslims' hatred is a development of really the last century and has a lot more to do with Marxism and opposition to Western imperialism kind of mapped onto the Muslim religion than it actually has anything to do with historic Islamic attitudes. You know, there are some statements in the Quran, but the fact is that Jews, for most of Islam's history, Jews have been in approximately the same situation in Muslim worlds as they were in Christian worlds. Sometimes they lived at peace, sometimes things went well, sometimes things were very bad, and it varied, you know, so. But again, I think the underlying issue is that you've got a nation, a people that is different, that is loyal to oneself, that hides their identity a lot of times. They would take on the names and the language and the dress and so forth, and yet they would still be separate. You know, if you've got a people that's living among you who is not loyal to you, then in times of crisis, you're going to blame them.
So, like the Muslims in America, and in other countries, they do that too, don't they? They keep their own identity, they stay separate.
Well, it varies. It depends on what, you know, if they do. See, over time, yeah, well, I mean, there are those that do. There are lots of Muslims, especially ones that came here earlier, that would just very much become Americans, you know, and wouldn't have that kind of transnational loyalty. These days, when assimilation isn't really happening the way it should, you do see a lot of that happening. And there's, you know, in times of crisis, there will be hostility. You know, that's not, I mean, that happens all over the world all the time. You know, that what happened to, like, Chinese and Koreans who were living in Japan when war broke out against China, you know, what happened to Japanese and even some Germans in this country when war broke out against Germany and Japan. You know, that's...
Well, I know how I feel about people from Mexico in this country that just, they don't integrate. They stay to themselves, they keep their own language and customs.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes, I think, again, it depends on...
Yes, they do.
In the past, that wasn't so true. It is more true today when they continue to speak Spanish. And that's going to breed suspicion. It just does, yeah. You want to feel like people are on your side, especially when crises come, bad economic times or war or anything like that. That's when those passions really get inflamed. So I think that's what's going on. You know, like I said, I think the thing that is unique about the Jews is that they were, for many centuries, under the providence of God in a very special way, and I think that stamps their character even today, so that they do remain together in a way that lots of other people haven't. You know, there's been migrations and movements, and that's gone on forever and ever, but usually people just blend into their new circumstances. Jews really don't. They never have. They probably do in America more than they have anywhere else, but still, they're still who they are, you know. Well, are there any other questions? Why don't we close in prayer? Gracious God and Father, thank you for your blessings. Thank you for your Son, Jesus Christ, and for his salvation of us, that you have sent a king that will bring peace and will bring goodwill from you to us, that will heal the breach between heaven and earth, Lord. We thank you for that, and we pray that you grant us faith to put our trust in him, to look for him, to him for our salvation and our peace, and grant us that confidence to know that we have everything we would need and desire in him, in Jesus Christ. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.